Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is your good friend, the very esteemed and well-travelled Clarence Copernicus Cloverleaf, welcoming you to another exciting edition of Cloverleaf Radio, hosted by the host with the most, Jimmy Falcon. You can always feel free to call in at 602-753-1883 to ask a question to the host or any of his well-established guests. Just please remember when calling in to be on your best behavior. This is a G-rated show, you know. Hey, that was a wicked rhyme. Anywho, just be sure to be kind and courteous. Now, on to the main event.
All righty, we are back for an exciting edition of Cloverleaf Radio. I am, as always, the host of the most, Jimmy Falcon. Hope everybody's having a great day. I am back in the land of issues with my computer. See, I can do the whole safe mode, start it up, and yada yada, bing bang. But it won't let me access the studio in safe mode. Go figure. So, ipso facto, I'm having an issue at the moment. Our special guest, special effects legend, the Monster Maker, Steve Johnson, is on the line waiting for me to click to get him on the line and on the air with us. And I hear him clicking, Steve, give me 1 second, man. I'm so sorry about this. This is one of those things where I always tell people, this is one of the most professional, unprofessional shows you'll ever get. And there we go. We got the studio back on. And I'll let Steve know why as soon as I get him on the air, because I feel like a dingus. Oh, my goodness. So the reason why this is the most professional interview ever is because, stuff like this happens. I don't have a lavish studio. There he is. There's Steve. I don't have a lavish studio or anything. I'm doing this on my own, and unfortunately I live on a farm. And I got 9 dogs. So welcome to the madness. Welcome to Cloverleaf Radio, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Excellent. So I'm here, and oh my God, what have I gotten myself into? I just heard in your intro that this is a G-rated program. You are speaking to the wrong person, my friend.
Well, see, the whole
G-rated
thing.
Please just get up right now, because I have no filter. I can't control myself.
Well, I'll just let you know this. The G-rated thing, of course, we're on the internet, so it's not like the FCC is pounding on my back door, and we're actually moving out of that G-rated thing. I just have to call Clarence Cloverleaf. The guy's like 85 years old or something. I got to get him to make a new intro, but no, you're fine.
Okay, so are we live now? Is this show actually live?
No, we're live. I don't have a call thing or a call screen thing or anything, but yeah. So I guess starting off, you were from Houston, Texas, and being from the Midwest, I think that you would end up being a farmer or a rancher or a cowboy. What made you want to get to California in the nitty-gritty heart of it and get into movies and entertainment?
I came out of the womb wanting to make monsters. I've never wanted to do anything else. I mean, since I could speak, since I could do rudimentary writing in kindergarten, all I wanted to do was make stuff. That's all I ever wanted to do. I was really fascinated with the Hammer films and the Universal horror films as a kid, and I figured out at some point somebody's making that stuff, so why not me?
And the technology, especially since, the 30s, and the Universal, the legendary Universal films like Frankenstein and The Mummy, that looks great now. But thinking about making The Mummy in 2018 or making it even in the 90s with the technology you had or in the 80s, so much more has come along. I think it's just amazing.
Right. Well, it's a double-edged sword because I really like very, very simple Lon Chaney Sr. type effects like Phantom of the Opera, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Mr. Wu, all the stuff that Lon Chaney Sr. did way back in the 20s in the silent film era. I really enjoy that. I've tried to bring that into my own work. I think that there's a fluidity and a natural quality of doing stuff that's not overly planned And in this new age of digital technology, the one thing you could say about it is it's overly planned to the nth degree, because you don't have to decide until answer print. You know, I mean, in the old days, when we would make an animatronic or we'd do a prosthetic character, once the director said cut, that was what was going to be on the screen for the rest of forever. But now, throughout post-production with digital technology, they can keep fucking with it and fucking, oopsie, I said fuck. They can keep screwing with it. Oh, look, I said screw. I can't help myself. They can keep changing.
I kind of think, you know, maybe that's why I turned it into a G-rated show, is because I curse so much in normal life that maybe I thought I could have 30 minutes where I wouldn't do it, but I'm finding myself more and more doing it, so you're absolutely fine.
Well, my point being, with digital technology, you can continue to change it after the fact, and you know the old saying, too many cooks in the kitchen ruin the stew, and I think that's what happens a lot these days, because there are no more spearheads, there are no more... I mean, do you know the name of a single digital animator? No, but you know Rick Baker, you know Dick Smith, you know Stan Winston, you know Rob Bottin. You know, it's just too many cooks in the kitchen, and that's one of the reasons why I kind of got fed up with the business and kind of took off, so I could develop a new art form that would not have too many cooks in the kitchen. And what I'm doing is writing now, and it's amazing, wonderfully satisfying. As a matter of fact, all morning today, I was doing my final edit, my absolute final edit on my new book, Rubberhead 2.
Wow. That's definitely a change of pace, I'm sure, going from doing stuff with your hands and being on sets and being around tons of people to being by yourself in a quiet area where you can be with yourself and your laptop or tablet or pen and paper or what have you, and just...
Yeah, it's a healing experience, and you know I do like working with people, but the difference between writing and making monsters is very similar. I just think that I'm sculpting with words now, because I'm really, you know, using a mental tactic to get into your head and to show you something that you never could have imagined yourself. It's the same thing as doing it through sculpture and mold making and animatronics. It really is. It's just using a different road to get there. And there are fewer people in the way that are going to screw you up, because when I write, I'm the director, I'm the casting agent, I'm the production designer, I'm the actors, I'm the sound designer, I'm the editor, I'm everything. So it's really, really, really a wonderfully freeing experience. And I've been doing this for about 10 years full time now, and it's really, really been wonderfully exciting. But, you know, you're right. It's I do kind of miss working with other people. Because it does get lonely. I mean, why do you think so many writers kill themselves? You're just living in your head 24 hours a day. And there's this constellation of ideas and concepts that you have to constantly keep. It's like writing a book is like having homework 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Because you can never, ever, ever have a break from it, because you'll lose your way.
Exactly. Thank you. Like that just... That's crazy. That's kind of how I feel about radio sometimes. But just, I get it. You know, you're trying to fall asleep at night, and you're almost there, and you're like, holy cow, this guy can have a tentacle coming out of who knows where. And you're like, you got to write it down. You got to sketch it. You got to put pad to paper, and ideas keep coming out. And then, you know, it's like 10 o'clock at night, and you're like, what the heck? It's been a whole other day.
Yeah, and there's a lot of math and science involved with actual physical practical effects that is not involved with writing, because I can write anything I want and I don't have to worry about how much it's going to cost or who's going to make it, or if I can get the best sculptor, if the effect's even going to work. Because if I can make it work in words and take that leap from my mind to yours, then guess what? It's going to work.
Absolutely. And, you know, you did make a good point. The effect is better now in some ways than they were in the past. But then again, you know, I'll bring up Ghostbusters, because that was kind of where my next question was going. You know, Slimer or Onionhead from the original film that you created versus the Slimer from the 2016 Ghostbusters, there's nothing alike about it. You can just go, oh, that's a computer. But I feel like watching an older film, you can go, that actually, you know, you can tell that looks realistic. There's probably someone underneath that. You know, there's so much more when you could put a human being under some layers of makeup or robotics under it and just make it come to life instead of, like you said, making it all digital.
Well, it's a stylistic choice. It's why stop-motion animation is still thriving these days, even more so than it ever did from its inception with Willis O'Brien from the original King Kong and Ray Harryhausen, of course. It's a stylistic choice, and there's a huge nostalgia for handmade creations, and so it's starting to happen again. People are using these handmade techniques again. It's a battle. It's like it really is a war now between digital technology and practical effects, and you can see it all online. The question comes up over and over and over, but I see it as a battle. I see it as yet another tool, and if it's used properly, the blending of those two things just, it cuts the strings from the marionette, because we can use green screen now and erase puppeteers, like the new Labyrinth TV show. Jim Henson did all the puppets. It's 100% practical, but they use digital technology to remove the puppeteers, remove the rods, cut the strings from the marionette, which you couldn't have done very easily back when they did the original Labyrinth. So there's good and bad.
Sure, you bring up stop motion. I was thinking about the California Raisins today, which I grew up on, and then thinking to now the Grand Slam, the Denny's, internet cartoon commercial thing, is stop motion. And you're right, it's kind of a digital versus analog kind of way these days.
Well, even when you do an actual stop motion piece these days, it's done digitally. And when I say that, in the old days, Ray Harryhausen and Willis O'Brien on King Kong, they had to shoot one frame at a time, move the puppet a tiny bit, write another frame, on and on and on, and then wait for the film to be processed to see if the shot worked or not. Sometimes they'd lose days because if the shot didn't work, it took a week to get the film back before they knew that. But now you shoot with a digital camera, and you go through the motions of moving your puppet one shot, one frame at a time, shooting it one frame at a time, and you can instantly play it back and see if it worked. You know what I mean? So it's a wonderful advantage.
I guess there's give and take. There's give and take on that. But, back to Ghostbusters.
Hey, hang on. Aren't there two guys here? I thought there were two of you guys. Do we have a second guy on?
No. It's the whole Ian Booth or Jimmy Falcon thing.
Oh, so I'm confused. I thought it was a double thing here.
No, Ian Boothby is my real name. Jimmy Falcon is the one I use on the radio. Because Ian Boothby is already there's a guy named Ian Boothby that did stuff for comics of The Simpsons and stuff.
Yeah, but what about
I was
Clarence
always getting confused
Cloverleaf?
With him.
Who's Clarence Cloverleaf? Are you
that's not me. That's a pre-recorded thing. That's a whole different person.
Gotcha.
He's my spokesman. He's my spokesman. He welcomes us. Welcomes everyone, I guess. But sorry for the confusion.
Okay, very good.
But
so what's next?
Well, I was gonna say, back to Ghostbusters. Ghostbusters for a second. How did you, without, saying it a million ways, because I'm sure you've been asked this question a million times, what were some of the things that you put into Slimer or Onion Head that maybe you had never done before that maybe you haven't done since?
Well, when I read the script, I didn't like it, kind of figure it out, and that just shows how naive I am when it comes to reading scripts and deciding it's worth my time or not. I thought it was a joke. I didn't get it. Because when you read a perfect example is also a big trouble in China, because when you read a script like that, you don't know what Kurt Russell is going to bring to it. You don't know what Kim Cattrall is going to bring to it. You don't know what John Carpenter is going to bring to it. So all of these elements come into play, to get the final effect of what the film is. Same thing with Ghostbusters. I didn't know what Dan Aykroyd was going to bring to it. I didn't know what Ivan Reitman was going to bring to it. I had no idea. But what I did know was, it was a cartoony kind of film, and I really wanted to break new ground with the creations. And, I read it as a cartoon, I created Slimer as a cartoon, because what I had learned before from Rick Baker and Rob Bottin and Greg Canham and all these other Oscar-winning makeup effects people that I had apprenticed with was if you make an animatronic, you put a bicycle cable on the side of a mouth and you pull it and that makes it smile. Or you put a bicycle cable on the brow and you pull it and you get, makes it, you know, makes the brows get angry. And I thought, wait a minute, when you watch a Tex Avery cartoon, for instance, classic cartoon director, when these characters smile, their whole head deforms. Sometimes the head will flatten, the cheeks will grow to be three times, five times their size. And so what I wanted to do with Slimer was create just a big, floppy, useless piece of rubber that would jiggle like a bowl full of jelly that we could actually put puppeteers in and behind, because we shot on a black stage because we had to double expose Slimer photochemically into the shot. So we were given the opportunity of shooting on a black stage. So what I did is I put all the puppeteers in black outfits and just had them physically manipulate the puppet. I mean, there was a guy wearing it, and there were a couple of animatronic functions, like the eyes blinked. But everything else, literally, we just manipulated it by hand through slits in the big floppy piece of foam rubber. Because, number one, we could get it to completely deform itself and go crazy, something I'd never seen before, something I thought the film demanded. And number two, it can't break. Nothing can break if it's just human hands, right? Sure. So it was kind of ahead of its time in that respect, because I kind of went way retro. Again, it leads back to the amazing techniques that Lon Chaney Sr. came up with back in the silent film era. I always think that the simplest answer is the best answer.
That's deep. You should sell T-shirts to say that the simplest answer is the
I'm
best
sorry,
answer.
I beg your pardon?
I said you should sell T-shirts that say that. You could make $1 million.
Yeah, well, it's called Occam's Razor. It's a scientific kind of saying. It's the most obvious answer is usually, almost always, the right answer.
Wow. That is very deep, sir. And before we wrap up, I thank you so very much for joining me. I could talk to you for hours because there's so much of your work that I loved. Who wasn't in love or had a crush on Syl for a little bit until that got creepy? And, of course, you know, Night of the Living Dead 3. Wow. She was dead but gorgeous. You did some great work, sir. Final question I always like to ask is, what does the future hold for you? You touched on the new book. You know, where can people find you if they want to get the book, if they want to follow you, if they want to see, you know, what's coming next from your fabulous mind?
Well, my big thing right now, and I've been working on this for years, and there's some wonderful new developments now, is a television show. I'm producing a documentary right now that's basically about the glory days of special effects, and it kind of stars me, and it's based on the first volume of Rubberhead. Which, by the way, there's only about 2 cases left, meaning 20 books. If you want to order Rubberhead Volume 1, you can order it on my website, which is stevejohnsonfx.com. And right now, I'm also – you can pre-order Volume 2. Volume 2 is not going to be out for a month or two. And like I said, I was just finishing the edit today. You can pre-order Volume 2 at rubberhead.bigcartel.com. But yeah, we're working on this documentary, which is the doorway, the open doorway to a television show that we're also working on producing. And the television show is based on basically me being the Anthony Bourdain of special effects, where I travel the world. It's very cultural, but I go to film sets and I go to special effects studios all over the world, and we eat and we laugh, we talk about technology, and we go way back into you know, the glory days, because there's such a nostalgia these days for the movies of the 80s and 90s that I worked on and that all of my peers worked on. So, yeah, I was born to be on television. I'm going to be on television, and that's my new thing. This book series has kind of become the door that has opened that. You know, because I think that there's an open, gaping hole on television right now. There's so much content needed, and I think I'm the guy to fill it. I think I'm going to be the new Anthony Bourdain, not of food, but of special effects. And if you look at Anthony's stuff, he's a huge hero of mine, and I'm so sorry that he died the way he did in particular. You know, when he goes around the world and he travels, it's really not just about food. So this show won't just be about effects. It'll be about culture and adventure And it'll be based on effects, just like Anthony's shows were based on food. But it's not just about effects, like Anthony's weren't just about food. And I'm really, really excited about that because I think the time has come for a show like that.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of stuff on television. It's not necessarily original content. They're really up on bringing back series even when I was growing up, and that's sad. I agree that there's a need for new content, and I think what you have planned is definitely going to fill in the void where people need it the most.
Yeah, and if you look out there, I mean, there's so many stations, so many networks, so much crap content out there that how could this one go wrong? I mean, look at me. I was born to be on television, for God's sake. I'm incredibly handsome, incredibly witty, and a super genius, has been. So who doesn't want to watch that? Watch me travel all over the world, getting drunk, interviewing effects people, and eating with them, and having adventures with them. And as a matter of fact, we're going to shoot our test pilot next month in Belgium.
Wow. Yeah, so that's where Belgium comes into the click.
Well, I was
very
just
cool,
there,
man.
And it went so well that we're going to do another class over there, and the producers of the show are going to send a team with me, because had they sent a team last time, we'd already have it. So we're not going to waste another trip to Belgium, because Belgium is an amazing country filled with amazing people, amazing experiences, so exciting, and it's a country that not a lot of people ever think about. I mean, I don't even think I can think of a show where Anthony Bourdain went there, and he should have.
Well, thank you so, so very much, Steve, for joining me. I know you're a busy guy, sir. I really appreciate the time. And have a great night. Enjoy the weather. I'm sure it's a lot better there than it is here in the Midwest.
All right, cool. So just 20 minutes, that's it? You got nothing else to ask me?
Well, I could keep going. I just figured you're a busy guy, and I say 15 to 20 minutes. I don't want to take too long, so... Yeah, of course I could ask more things.
I don't know. I put some time aside for you. It seems like 20 minutes is too short. We could go another 10 or 15 if you like.
Well, I have a 30-minute total running time, and that's unfortunately beyond my control. But, yeah, I got time for one more question. I'm not gonna say no to that. You know, I guess I'll bring up Night of the Living Dead, because especially now it seems like there's been a resurgence in zombie stuff, whether it's The Walking Dead, The Nation, just your good old gory zombie film that's campy and horror-y and fun. You know, going back to, you know, the early 90s when you worked on that film and not having, you know, maybe some of the stuff they have today, but still having great effects and great work, you know, how did all that come about in your mind? How did you want to create her character?
Well, we're talking about Return of the Living Dead Part 3, right? The Brian Yuzna film.
Yes.
Yeah, Mandy
Absolutely.
Clark, I forget the name of her character, the one that's self-harming, the one that cuts herself. Yeah.
Julie, I had a thought.
Julie, right. Now, I've worked with Brian on so many films, Necronomicon, Arachnid, I think, a giant spider movie that we shot in Spain. I love Brian. I still go out drinking with him occasionally. Brian Yuzna, the director writer of that film. And he's one of the few director writers. Tom Holland is another one. James Cameron is another one. John Landis, one of the few that I respect and I don't heads with. So when Brian tells me, no, I don't like it, why don't you try this? I actually listen to him instead of saying, you idiot, you're wrong and I'm right. So really, Brian designed that, because I started out with a much more subtle version of it. And Brian thought, no, we need to make these glass shards bigger. We need to treat this that way. We need to do this this way. And because this is the thing about working in film. It's such a collaborative experience that if you're collaborating with someone that you don't trust, it's just going to end up being a nightmare. But I always like working with Brian. And so I have to say that Brian designed that makeup. And Mindy Clark herself was totally cool. Full body makeup. Must have taken 8 hours a day. She was totally cool too. And it almost looks classic. When you see her first reveal, when she comes through that lit doorway, it's like when you see the Frankenstein monster for the first time in the 1931 original Frankenstein, the Universal film. So, yeah, that was a collaboration totally between Mindy Brian and myself. And that's when things work really well, when the actor, director, and the effects person all trust each other and are willing to go for it.
See, and that's something else I didn't know. And everybody learned something. Because I guess you kind of think of, maybe you think of effects and makeup and props as being a one-person thing in certain areas. But to have the actor and, you know, have someone else giving you input and being able to put it together, that's awesome. I just think that when she came through the door, she was a little too sexy to be the Frankenstein monster. But I get your point there.
She was like a sexy Frankenstein monster. But, you know, good actors always want to have input. Like Gary Oldman recently and The Darkest Hour, the Winston Churchill makeup, he was very, very involved in that. You know, the best actors, like Mike Myers, when I did Cat in the Hat, he was very, very involved in that. That's why he fired Rick Baker, because Rick Baker wanted to do a full face makeup, and he really wanted to bury Mike's face under rubber, like he did with Jim Carrey on The Grinch. And Mike didn't want that. Mike wanted a very subtle appliance. So when Mike called me to replace Rick Baker on that project, I just said, okay, I'll do whatever you want because you're the boss.
Wow.
I mean, and it is actually his face. It is actually his face on screen. I'm the behind-the-scenes guy. It's actually, you know, him carrying the movie. So who am I to deny what he wants, especially if they're paying me millions of dollars to do it?
Yeah, that would be hard, though, I guess. That'd be kind of like being vice president. Your president gets kicked out. Then you're in charge, and you're kind of like, well, he was kind of my cohort or my co-operator of this place, but now, you know, no matter the respect I have for him, I have to do this job now and go for it.
Well, that's what that project actually did become. It became a job, because by the time Mike let Rick go off the project, we had like 4 or 5 months to do all of those effects, all of those suits, and so there was no time for argument. There was no time for argument at all. And I had been warned by K&B, the company that does The Walking Dead, because they had done the Fat Bastard suit for Mike in Austin Powers 2, and they said, he's insane, don't ever work with him. I had no problems with Mike, because I just listened to him, because we had no time for arguments. We just had to say, let's go. We've got a deadline that we're racing toward. We just have to be friends, and we have to make this work, because we start shooting in 4 months. So let's just do it. Let's get together. Let's get down in the trenches, and let's fire at the same enemy.
Wow. But yeah, I mean, you all. Eventually, you're going to hear that Jim Carrey or Mike Myers or so-and-so is not great. They're a jerk. But until you have that personal experience, you know, being with them or working with them, then only you will know the truth.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Like working with Robin Williams on Bicentennial Man. I mean, he was such a gentleman. He was so cool. And we had to bolt him. It took over an hour to bolt him into that robot costume every day. And we had to actually, with remote controls and servo motors in his head, perform it for him. So we had to create a kind of like a language of, you know, if he tilted his head one way, we'd move his eyebrows up. So it was really a co-production of his performance, and it was really cool. But that was literally Robin wearing that robot suit the entire movie. There's only a couple of shots or somebody else, like really dangerous stunts. But Robin wanted to wear the robot suit because he felt like if somebody else wore it, it wouldn't be his performance, because he's got that patented way of moving. And so that was another great example of working with someone where we actually created their performance.
That is absolutely cool. Well, I'm sure you hear the audience can't hear it, but it's very visible to me. I'm sure you hear the 30 seconds, 90 seconds. So we are running out of time, unfortunately.
Okay.
Thank you so very much, Steve. Anything else you'd like to say? Would you have a few couple minutes?
No, I mean, you can follow me on Instagram, but again, if it's G-rated, my Instagram name is at Steve Fuckin with no G, F-U-C-K-I-N, Fuckin Johnson, on Instagram. You can pick up Volume 1. There's only a couple cases left on my website, stevejohnsonfx.com, And you can pre-order Volume 2, which will be available in a couple of months, on rubberhead.bigcartel, like a drug cartel, rubberhead.bigcartel.com. And so, yeah, I pimped my stuff. That's it.
All righty. We have officially went into the archives. Thank you so very much, Steve. And, of course, I can give you the link and promote it as well for anyone that may have missed the show or would like to hear it again or download it, what may have you.
All right. Very good.
All right. Thanks a lot, Steve.
All right. Nice chat.
All right. Bye-bye. All righty. Wow. A great interview, but my puppy just flew into the room. I mean, flew in like a bat out of hell. So that means it's time to go on the walk. Thank you so very much, everyone, for listening. I kind of got stage fright there because sometimes, 10 years later and sometimes there's that person that comes on that I'm so enamored, so love their work, that it's kind of hard to maintain my composure and not go fanboy or mark out, as we say in the wrestling business. All right, everyone, we will be back on September 12th. Actor Neil Ross returns to the show promoting his new book, Vocal Recall, available now at neilbook.com. Of course, Artistry Con coming up just over a month away, November 16th, 17th, and 18th, 2018 at the Garden Hotel in Urbana, Illinois. We're back at the Garden, not Madison Square, the Garden Hotel, and we're going to rock it like never before. Check out dhhcon.com or Dark History and Horror Con on Facebook for tickets and more information. And to check out all the great guests have already been named. Robert Lissardo, of course, returning back from Death Race, Human Centipede 3, and tons of other horror, gory, fun, scary movies, along with a bunch more. If you want to know the real full list of guests, find Dark History and Horror Con, my man Brian Ward. And, of course, we got Salem 20 Comic Expo coming up in April 2019 back in Salem, Illinois for the third year. Hopefully, all goes well and right. I will be there this year. I've never had that many issues trying to get to something. SoCon 2019 returns September 6th and 7th back to Trosky Mall in Mattoon. Of course, there was an issue last year. Not really an issue, but the mall changed ownership. And, I guess we were kind of out, weren't sure how many events, what events they were going to do at all, if they were going to keep stuff the same or whatnot. So there was not one last year, but 2019 should be bigger and better than ever. We will definitely be back for that. So thank you very much to Steve Johnson, and of course, thank you to everyone. We will see you on the 12th for Neil Ross. Thanks everybody for listening. Have a great night.